Shema Yisrael.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generation.
Al Yovad Yisrael, Omerim Shema.
The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, Portrait of Dedication, was written by Peter Lyon.
Genocide, noun, from the Greek genos, meaning race or tribe, plus the suffix side from the Latin meaning to kill. Genocide, which is to say, the destruction of a human group, racial, ethnic, religious, or national, by slaughter, starvation, sterilization, compulsory abortion, mass kidnapping, or similar violent means. Genocide. On December 9, 1948, it was stigmatized by the United Nations as a crime. And why not? Hasn't it always been a crime to kill people? That would seem logical, wouldn't it? But no, such mass killing has not always been considered a crime. For our civilization has in the past accepted it as legitimate, sometimes necessary, sometimes even quite moral. But every now and then there grows up a human being who sees where all the rest of us are blind, who is the only man in the parade who is marching in step, who alone is sane, so that we are all of us driven to call him crazy. Today we shall tell you the story of one such man. The man whose life has been one struggle to make the rest of us agree that to destroy a group of human beings is a crime. And we have not yet agreed. A boy sits curled up in a comfortable chair in his home near Warsaw. He is reading a stirring romantic tale called Quo Vadis, and as he reads, his eyes open wide with an astonished curiosity. At length, he puts the book aside and goes to seek his mother.
Mother, are you busy?
In a moment, dear. What is it?
Mother, if a man kills another man, the policeman comes to arrest him. Isn't it so?
Yes, that's so, Raphael.
But...
why do you ask, dear?
Well, the book I'm reading.
Quo Vadis? Yes.
What? Well, in this book, the story tells how they took the Christians, in Rome this is... they took the Christians and they threw them into an arena to be killed by lions.
Yes, Raphael.
But wasn't this a bad thing to do? Wasn't it wrong?
It was very wrong, dear.
But then...
you wonder why, if this was wrong, people could sit in the seats around the arena and look on, even applaud, is that
it? Yes.
You're right, Raphael. The thing they did in Rome to the Christians was very wrong. And what made it most evil was that the people looked on. For as long as people look on while such a thing is done... and do not raise their hands against it. For that long, the thing will go unpunished.
They do not throw people to lions to be eaten today.
No, dear. They no longer throw people to lions.
Today, if a man is killed by another man, he is arrested?
Well...
well, isn't he arrested today?
Yes, dear. Today, he is arrested.
The boy was relieved. He was a sensitive youngster. When he studied history, he lived it. He lived in Carthage when the Romans destroyed that seaport town and slaughtered all its inhabitants just because they were Carthaginians. He read of the massacre on the eve of St. Bartholomew's in France, and his eyes filled with tears. And he looked for the logic in such killings. Or if not the logic, at least for the reason.
Huguenots? Well, the Huguenots were a group in France who wished to worship their god in their own way, Raphael.
And for this they were killed?
Yes, dear. For this they were killed.
Those who killed, they thought they were doing a good thing, didn't they? A very moral thing.
Yes, I imagine they did.
I wonder if they felt their god would be proud of them for killing people who did not worship him.
If they did not feel so, they would not be able to kill.
Yes. Still...
Yes, dear?
It is very difficult to decide what is good and moral.
Wise men have considered such questions for many centuries, dear. You have plenty of time before you to read what they have written or to decide for yourself.
No wise man can write that it is good or moral to kill others, no matter what the excuse. In war, perhaps it is necessary to kill, to defend yourself. But this was not war.
No. No, it was not in war, and it was not right.
The boy grew up, went to the university at Lvov, and studied hard. He was a young man with an exceptional head on his shoulders. He chose to specialize in the law. The law deals with what is right and what is wrong, with what is a crime and what is not. And the questions which had come to him when he was a boy were still with him. Of course, he didn't lack for reminders. It was in the early 20s, when the young man was still a student, that a few hundred miles to the west one day, an Armenian approached a Turk on the streets of Berlin. The Turk, who had been a minister of the interior in his country before coming to Berlin, was Talat Pasha. The Armenian had a gun in his hand, which he raised and pointed at the Turk. If he said anything at all, it was probably no more than,
"This is for vengeance."
Vengeance. The Armenian was a member of a society sworn to avenge the slaughter by the Turks of 1,200,000 Armenians. He was arrested, sent to jail, held for trial. And in Poland, in his university, Raphael considered the motive for the assassination and followed the course of the trial. With his professors, he discussed the case.
I understand he tried to get the German authorities to arrest Talat Pasha.
Of course, there is no law under which he could have been arrested. What had he done?
He was responsible for the death of more than 1 million human beings, slaughtered for no reason. But there is no law.
Let me give you an example, Lemkin. A man owns some chickens. He decides to kill them. He kills them. Why not? They are his.
The Armenians were not chickens, Professor. They were human beings.
Moreover, if you attempt to stop the man from killing his chickens, you open yourself up to the charge of trespass. Quite apart from the fact that you are meddling in an affair which is none of your business.
The chickens are one thing, Professor.
Similarly,
but...
if the government of Poland had presumed to interfere with the internal affairs of Turkey, not only would we have been meddling in an affair which was none of our concern, but we should have...
I know. Violating Turkish sovereignty.
Exactly.
Forget that. Who is the greater criminal? The Turk who is responsible for the death of more than 1 million? Or the Armenian who kills one man for revenge?
The Armenian, for he broke the law. The Turk did not.
The Turk broke no law, the Armenian did, and the world is mad. Perhaps you've forgotten precisely how demented the rest of us were, so I will remind you. The German court which tried the Armenian was successful in letting the Armenian off without a sentence, for they were able to convince the Armenian that he should plead insanity. The young law student Raphael Lemkin went on in his studies. He took his doctorate. He was appointed secretary to the Polish Court of Appeals. He was charged with the task of drafting a code of jurisprudence for his country. His career stretched out before him, honorable and successful. But still, the question of the crime that was no crime nagged at him. In Paris, in the middle 20s, on a crowded street one day, a man named Schwarzbart approached a Ukrainian exile and killed the Ukrainian. Schwarzbart's act was to revenge a pogrom which this Ukrainian had led against some Russian Jews. The Ukrainian had gone free. Schwarzbart was arrested, tried, and finally, after he had pleaded insanity, let off with a suspended sentence. And in Poland, young Raphael Lemkin coined a phrase to describe the two political assassinations.
The beautiful crimes. That's what they were. Beautiful crimes.
An associate reminded him.
Now, wait a minute, wait a minute. There's nothing right or just or beautiful about what those men did. They killed. They are neither of them God to strike down an evil man.
The beautiful crime.
Two wrongs, you know, they still don't make a right.
Those men, they were the instruments of a higher law.
They had no right. If they were acting as instruments for a higher law, I will say only that it's a law that no court recognizes.
But it will be recognized. It will be recognized.
And now Dr. Lemkin set about writing articles, starting discussions, lecturing, always on this question of the crime which was legal and sanctified. Because he had risen to a post of importance in his country, his voice was heard. Because he was a lawyer, and also a sensible man, he realized that in order to fight this crime, he would have to appeal not to the court of any nation, but to the court of international law. 1933. And Dr. Lemkin went to Madrid to the International Conference for the Unification of Criminal Law in order to submit a draft of an international convention
to outlaw internationally the destruction of religious, national, racial, and other human groups.
Lemkin had heard the arguments against his idea before in Poland. Now he heard the objections all over again in many languages.
But there's no such thing as exterminating whole groups of people.
He reminded them of the most recent instance in that very year, 1933, when the Iraqians had slaughtered 1,000 Christian Assyrians, wiped out a whole tribe, men, women, and children.
Who is this man?
The precocious lawyer from Poland.
I never heard of him.
Coming around here to tell us about international law.
What young Lemkin didn't seem to realize, for after all he was the only man in the parade who was in step, was that international law can take care of only three things. Piracy on the high seas, slavery, and the drug traffic. The older, wiser lawyers tried to explain this to him.
My dear fellow, you're simply barking up a tree that doesn't exist.
That's it exactly. How can you draft a law against something which in the first place doesn't exist? And in the second place, if it did exist, there's no crime anyway.
It's interference with internal affairs.
That was in 1933. The year, you will remember, when Hitler took power in Germany. In those days, Raphael Lemkin had risen to the post of public prosecutor in Warsaw. He didn't retain his job. He found that the newspapers of his native city were delightedly attacking him, his ideas, and his crusade. And so one day he told his mother,
I've resigned my post. You don't seem astonished.
No, dear. I've seen this coming. What goes on in your mind is not precisely a mystery to me.
Do you think I did wrong to resign?
No. If you can't work effectively...
And I can't, not while I'm being called a fool every day in the papers.
Exactly. And I don't imagine that the attacks are fortuitous. I imagine they were all planned.
So, now I shall write more articles.
There is something strange about being the only man with eyes in the country of the blind. It is as though you heard a man announce, poverty is a crime, it must be outlawed. And you stop to think and you realize, yes, maybe this is true, but after all, we have always had poverty. It's necessary. Maybe it's even good. For only under the goad of poverty will men work. Such nonsense is no more foolish than the nonsense against which Lemkin directed his articles. And in 1936, he fell desperately sick of pneumonia, and a strange thing happened. In the hospital outside his room, his physician talked about it to his mother.
It's delirium, of course.
Well, if his fever would only go down. He's not strong now.
What puzzles me is...
Yes, doctor?
Well, he keeps talking, only it's more than talking.
Yes, I know. I've listened.
It's a harangue. Always in German. I don't understand German too well.
I understand what he's saying.
Is it all nonsense?
Not exactly, I don't think.
What is it he's saying?
He's talking to some German officers.
German officers?
Army officers. Stormtroop officers.
But I don't...
He's imploring them not to kill. Not to kill people.
Very strange forms, the forms that delirium will take. I remember one...
He's begging them not to kill me.
Oh, why...
Now, that is very curious. Isn't it?
Yes. Or, of course, it may also be remarkable foresight.
Well, they had called Dr. Lemkin a visionary while they were calling him a fool. It's only right within the irony of things that he should have been permitted his prevision in a moment of delirium. And in 1939, the German officers moved east into Poland, and they sacked and pillaged and killed. And they burned down the house of Raphael Lemkin's family in the suburbs of Warsaw. And his mother they killed. And Raphael Lemkin fought in Warsaw and fought in the forests around Warsaw, was wounded by shrapnel fire, learned how much sustenance there is to be had from a diet of potatoes and roots, and at length made his way to the Baltic and by small boat to Sweden and to safety. Now, it happened during the war that the great powers agreed that the war makers, the Nazis, had committed great crimes against the peoples of the world. A covenant was reached and confirmed by the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and France, agreeing that war criminals should be prosecuted and punished. Was it a crime that 6 million Jews had been destroyed? Raphael Lemkin thought it was. He was in America at war's end and was assigned to advise the legal staff of the United States War Department at Nuremberg. But there they told him...
It's going to be very difficult to charge them with, what did you call it?
Genocide.
Yes, genocide. You see, Doctor, the trouble is, there is no...
No law against it, I know.
More important, there was no law against it at the time the crimes were permitted, if they are crimes.
Yes.
You know as well as I do what the legal mind thinks about ex post facto laws, Doctor.
I know.
Look... I'm as anxious as you are to see these Nazis get the book thrown at him. Tell you what I think you should do. You know that conference of lawyers that's going on in England?
At Cambridge, yes.
That's the one. There are 300 of the world's most conservative lawyers there. If they were to agree on a resolution that genocide is a crime we can charge these Nazis with, then we'll be able to include it in the Bill of Particulars. Otherwise...
I think it's a good idea.
Say, are you feeling okay?
Just a little tired, I think.
Yeah. You look pretty ragged. Do you think you could manage to fly to England and talk to this conference?
I can manage.
I'll get your plane reservations fixed up for you.
Fine, fine. The quicker, the better.
Yes, Raphael Lemkin was a little tired. He flew from Nuremberg to Croydon Airfield outside London, and as he was about to leave the plane, he collapsed. At the hospital, the English doctor smiled and told him...
You know, Professor, I think you must be trying to break all altitude records with your blood pressure. It's over 200.
I'm not trying to break a record, Doctor.
Well, after you've been in bed here for 2 or 3 weeks, I think you'll be all right. Rest is what you need chiefly.
Doctor, I promise you, if I stay in bed here for more than a day, my blood pressure will go up still higher.
What's that?
I have an appointment to make a speech in Cambridge day after tomorrow.
Oh, no, that's quite out of the question.
It's absolutely necessary. And I promise you that if I stay here in bed, my blood pressure will be above 250. I'm leaving for Cambridge tomorrow, and that's that.
At Cambridge, Raphael Lemkin spoke on the first day of the lawyers' conference. He pleaded his case in the morning, and the lawyers listened attentively. Afterward, there was some interest in what he had had to say.
Genocide. The word's all wrong, you know.
What's that?
Well, I mean to say the etymology is wrong. You've coined a word that has roots in two different languages, Greek and Roman. Well, it doesn't ring true.
If we're discussing philology, I will cite you many examples of words which come from two different languages. But I'm discussing the mass destruction of...
I wish the word weren't half Greek and half Latin.
Well, now, you know, it's very important when you're coining a word to keep the grammarians happy. At Cambridge, the lawyers did nothing except talk about what they might do tomorrow. Lemkin flew to Paris. The peace conference was about to get underway. He spoke to a member of the American delegation. Yes. Trouble is, we're so busy trying to make sense with the Russians, Lemkin, that I just don't think we'll be able to find time to put this genocide business on the agenda. After all, it's a peace conference, you know, not a...
But listen, I'm
Can't
sure you...
Can't you sympathize with my problem? How can we undertake a side issue like this when our hands are so full with the job of trying to sign a peace treaty?
To a member of the French delegation.
As a man, Lemkin, I could not agree with you more heartily, but I am a split personality. I'm also a diplomat. And as a diplomat...
To a member of the Ethiopian delegation.
But we are such a small country. Who will listen to us? And besides, they will say, but you are the victims. You are not objective. You have an extra grind.
He talked to the members of one nation's delegation after another's. At length, when he was admitted for an appointment, he noticed that the man he talked to looked at him with cold eyes, looked through him, into space, so that he felt he really wasn't there at all. Raphael Lemkin stopped talking. He went home to his hotel. And one morning, he found he could not get up. It would be romantic to be able to report that the member of some delegation heard that Dr. Raphael Lemkin was sick in bed, lying with a great world weariness alone in his hotel. The facts are of themselves even more interesting. The facts are that nobody knew he was there, and nobody cared very much. So, with his blood pressure approaching 250, Raphael Lemkin called for a doctor and was taken to the hospital with no fanfare whatsoever in order to have a breakdown. And it happened as he lay in bed. He turned on the radio by his bedside.
And a session of the United Nations General Assembly has been called for New York City in the United States of America and will convene in 6 weeks. The agenda for the session is now in process of formation and will be...
Nurse! Nurse!
Shh! Professor, you shouldn't make so much noise.
Nurse, I want you to get hold of the doctor and tell him I'm checking out of the hospital.
Oh, now really, Professor...
No arguments. I'm feeling better. I'm going back to the United States. Tell the doctor. Fix up all the papers for my release from the hospital. Fetch my clothes for me.
Raphael Lemkin was permitted to leave the hospital on the condition that he would not fly to America, but would go by boat. He arrived in this country when there were only a few days left to include new items on the agenda of the General Assembly session. It was a journey that had begun in Warsaw, had taken him to Madrid, to Paris and Berlin, back to Warsaw, to Stockholm, New York, Washington, Nuremberg, London, Cambridge, and Paris. Now he was back in New York again. Genocide was put on the agenda. Three nations, Panama, Cuba, and India, sponsored the resolution. It was at length adopted by the Assembly as a convention. So what? Well, so the United Nations has now approved a convention, a new international law, the fruition of one man's life work. Only, not yet. It's not a law yet. It requires ratification by the senates of 20 nations before the world will have agreed that genocide is a crime, before the rest of us will have opened our eyes to the fact that to destroy by murder, mass kidnapping, sterilization, starvation, enforced abortion, or other similar violent means is a crime. Before the rest of us will have understood that we must change in order to get into step. Before the rest of us can say that we are sane. None of the United Nations has yet ratified this convention. It occurs to me that the first nation so to ratify will qualify, however belatedly, as honorable. Today, we have told you the story of a man whose life has been one struggle to make the rest of us agree that to destroy a group of human beings is a crime. And we have not yet agreed.
If
you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 10 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to The Eternal Light, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. And now we take pleasure in presenting Judge Joseph Sherbo of the Supreme Bench of Baltimore City, speaking to you from Baltimore. Judge Sherbo.
Now that the Genocide Convention is a reality and is being submitted to the nations of the world for ratification, it is difficult for us to believe that only a short few months ago, weary yet undaunted Raphael Lemkin was waging the battle of genocide single-handedly in the face of universal indifference. And yet it is so. Only yesterday, the most ancient of all crimes, that of mass murder, was considered no crime at all. Like poverty and slavery, we took it for granted as part of the pattern of civilization. Over 1 million Christians perished in the Ottoman Empire and the Balkans. Countless Christian Assyrians were exterminated in Iraq. 6 million Jews and several million Poles and Slavs were wiped out by Hitler. And only within the past few years, over 1 million Muslims of Pakistan and an untold number of Hindus were victims of genocide. And the civilized world looked on and said, no law was broken, and to punish the murderers would be meddling in affairs which are of no concern to us. The time has come for us to heighten our understanding, broaden our vision, strengthen our faith. The battle against genocide is not yet won. The senates or parliaments of 20 nations, members of the United Nations, must ratify the Genocide Convention before it becomes international law. Not one has yet done so. But already the dedicated spirit of Raphael Lemkin has succeeded in winning world recognition for what he called a higher law, and historians of tomorrow will undoubtedly record this achievement as one of the greatest spiritual victories in the history of civilization.
Eternal Light drama today, Portrait of Dedication, was written by Peter Lyon. The music was composed by Morris Momorsky and conducted by Milton Katims. Cantor Robert Siegel sang the liturgical introduction. Featured as Lemkin was Joe DeSantis. The narrator was Alex Scorby. The production was under the direction of Frank Papp. Free time to present The Eternal Light is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. This weekly program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.